This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. A nonprofit group in eastern North Carolina is helping kids from Carteret, Craven, Jones, Lenoir, Onslow, Pamlico, and Pitt counties learn the game of golf. But it's not just about improving their golf swing or putting skills. It's about improving as an individual.
They get honesty, integrity, sportsmanship, perseverance, respect, responsibility, confidence.
Administrative assistant with the First Tee of Eastern North Carolina, Pamela Boyd.
We also teach them about respect for their environment, respect for other people's stuff, and then respect for themselves, and also to have pride in what you do.
The First Tee is a nationwide youth development organization that's reached more than 14 million young people since its inception. The Eastern North Carolina chapter started in Craven County in 2012, the brainchild of PGA professional at the Emerald Golf Course, Jerry Breel, and George Brooks, a Champions Tour caddy.
The two of them had noticed that there was a lack of students who were participating in golf, so they were wondering if there were any programs out there. George happens to be a caddy and was out at Pebble Beach, and he saw some First Tee students and realized that he wanted to bring the program here.
This Tuesday was the first meeting since taking a break over the winter. The group started off with a series of warm-ups and stretches.
I want to hear you count. You're going to go one, two, three, one.
Then it was time to hone their putting skills. Coach Brooks demonstrates the exercise.
This is a straight putt over here, and you want to keep your putter on the line of the string. Back, straight back and straight through.
One by one, each student steps up to a line of three golf balls set at different distances from the hole. Volunteers with the First Tee offer tips and advice to help the students sink the putt.
So remember, how far you take the club back determines how far it's going to go. So don't take it back quite as far as you did on that one.
When each student finishes, they reset the golf balls for the next person and shake each other's hands. The next person in line congratulates them on a job well done.
Good job. Thank you.
By participating in the program, students are exposed to positive values connected with the game of golf. For instance, honesty is one of the 9 core values.
We will go out there and we will work on the mechanics of golf. So you're working on your chipping, your putting, and your driving. Some of the kids who are in the higher levels will actually go out and play a couple holes. Well, when you go play holes, you're in charge of keeping your own score. It's not somebody else's responsibility to keep your score. So you will be demonstrating honesty in how you take your scores.
These core values resonate with fourth grader Molly McGuire.
I've been learning like lots of different stuff, how you have to be honest and make sure you play fair when you're playing golf. And some things that have helped me just through life and school and stuff like that.
Molly has been with the First Tee of ENC for a couple of years. Golf is a favorite pastime for her family. She says her dad encouraged her and her brother to get involved in the First Tee program.
So I started out as a beginner, but like now I've improved to the level where I think I'm pretty good at it.
Did I mention confidence is one of those core values? That particular one came in handy for sixth grader Nicholas Glover, a First Tee ENC participant.
One thing that I learned that helped me a lot is confidence, because I'm also an actor at the Civic Theater. And I remember I was doing my first show and I was really nervous, but I had learned about confidence here and I took that over to the theater and it helped me a lot.
Over the years, administrative assistant Pamela Boyd says participation in First Tee ENC is anywhere from 40 to 100 students. This year, she says they have 50 students ranging in age from 7 to 18 years old coming from across eastern North Carolina to learn the game of golf at the Emerald Golf Course in New Bern and Minnesota Country Club in Arapahoe. Eighth grader Donovan Swindell says the program has helped him learn valuable life skills, make friends, and get better at the game of golf. He has a goal to join New Bern High School's golf team next year.
Yes, definitely. And that's going to be one of the things I'm going to do. Besides like all the mini sports, this is probably going to be one thing I'm going to do.
To learn more about the First Tee of Eastern North Carolina, visit our website, publicradioeast.org. After 2 years of planning and discussion, officials at Hammocks Beach State Park in Onslow County will soon make a decision as to what they'll do with 300 acres of additional land they acquired in 2015. Maps of the plans indicate expanded new facilities like hiking trails, RV sites, and possibly motorized boat access. Chris Thomas spoke with the park's ranger, Sarah Kendrick, about the future of the park and its impact on eastern North Carolina.
Well, there's so few places on the coast, in North Carolina at least, where you can hike in the woods and camp in the woods. You know, there's the Croatan, and there's a couple of state parks here and there that you can do that. But in the Swansboro area, other than the Croatan, there's not a lot of, you know, your standard in-the-woods type camping. Everybody wants to go to the beach and do stuff on the beach.
How long have you all been considering what to do with that 300 extra acres?
Well, it really depends on who you ask. People who have kind of been involved in this process over the last, probably 10 years now, they've been thinking about it since day one, you know, since the idea even came in that we should own this property. But we've really been working on the master plan since last summer when Sage Design came on board and was hired to design the property for us.
And what have they returned? What's part of this master plan?
So far, they've held two public comment sessions. The first one was last fall, which is really is the time for folks to come in and see some pictures of the new property and give them their ideas, just everything they could possibly desire to have on this property. They spoke to Sage Design about. The second meeting was where Sage Design came in and actually had two kind of plans to show folks based on that first meeting and what amenities people wanted. People could look at them and say, oh, well, I like this, but I don't like this, or I like this plan, but I like it better on the other one. And now we're in the phase where Sage Design is getting it all together and making one good final plan for us to review.
During those feedback sessions in person and online, what have you learned from the community?
They are very passionate about what they want to see on this property. There are a lot of people who really just want to see us preserve it. There's a lot of people who really want camping and really want hiking trails.
What other comments did you get a lot of from stakeholders and from people who really invested emotionally in this project?
There was a lot of initial controversy about a boat ramp, whether there should or should not be a boat ramp on the property. And Sage Design has taken, I'm sure, hundreds of comments on either side of that. But for the most part, people really want to see camping, fishing access. There's not a lot of places, you know, unless you take a boat, there's not a lot of places to go fishing, especially here in the park. That's probably one of our number one questions. Between camping, hiking, and fishing, that's probably our top three requested things on a daily basis, you know, at the front desk. So people want to see that. They want to see kayak access.
You mentioned a boat ramp controversy. Was it a matter of that preservation and ecology sort of line versus the recreational line? Was that kind of the prevailing?
Absolutely. I think people are just really passionate about it either way. There's folks that really want a boat ramp in Swansboro, and there's folks that really don't want a boat ramp in Swansboro. You know, you've got both sides of the coin, and I think Sage Design handled that very well.
And along those lines, how are you able to work with the, you know, the people who are really jazzed about preservation and ecology versus the recreational groups? You know, that seemed was that a difficult balance to keep?
Yeah, I think Sage Design's done a very good job. They did a lot of studies. They mapped a lot of things onto this property. They found existing oyster beds, existing longleaf pine forests, different areas, different wetland areas that need to be protected. So they did a lot of research on this area. And I think their end goal is to make sure that we have a good balance of conservation, recreation, and then environmental education. And those are the three primary goals of the North Carolina State Park System. So it's kind of like a three-legged stool. We talk about it a lot.
And how is that three-legged stool propped up under these two maps? I guess what do they have in common as far as that three-legged stool is concerned?
They all include conservation areas. They both include recreation, different types of recreation, whether it be boating access, fishing access, hiking trails, camping. And then they all include redesigning our exhibits to include the new property. So there's a lot of history that comes along with these new areas of the park. They've recommended in these two plans signage and new exhibits and things like that to be included in different parts of the park and in our current visitor centers.
I know there was a comments period. That window has closed. There were two public meetings. Those have ended, but mm-hmm. It looks like there is a third public meeting coming up. Could you tell us about that?
Sure. The final meeting, the Sage Design folks will have a draft final plan, and at that point it may be a final plan, and the meeting will be tentatively set for April 27th from 4 to 6 here at the park. People can come in and see what Sage Design has recommended to the division.
So now that you've had all these public comment periods and been working with the designers, what's the timetable looking like now as far as construction and completion?
So the mainland area plan is pretty much just a roadmap. Things won't happen overnight. And obviously, some of the smaller projects could happen quickly, some of the more inexpensive projects.
So this isn't something that's really so much on a timetable, but it's kind of an ongoing process?
Right. The Sage Design will give us recommendations of things, things you can do immediately, things maybe that might take 5 to 10 years, things that might take 20 years. And it'll all depend on funding from the state and other organizations. It may happen in 10 years, may happen in 20, who knows?
Sarah Kendrick is Parks Superintendent at Hammocks Beach State Park in Onslow County. Sarah, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Whether you've lived in Eastern North Carolina all your life or you're new to the area, you've probably noticed the weather in Eastern North Carolina can be strange. In New Bern, it can be pouring down rain, and just 35 miles away along the Crystal Coast, it's sunny and 80 degrees. Scientists in Eastern North Carolina want a clearer picture of where and how much precipitation falls throughout different communities in the region. That's why the National Weather Service is seeking volunteers who want to join a grassroots network of backyard weather observers that measure and map precipitation amounts. The data is used in natural resource, education, and research applications. Today, Mac McKee speaks with meteorologist with the National Weather Service office in Newport, David Glenn, about the collaborative rain, hail, and snow network.
Now, that's quite a mouthful, so I guess we'll call it by its acronym, like COCORAS.
That's right. I know it sounds like a fruity cereal you might eat in the morning, but it's actually a fairly unique acronym there for the Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network.
Now, how long has it been in existence here in North Carolina?
Well, in North Carolina, it began in 2007, and it slowly, over the years, built up to several hundred folks across North Carolina. When we have precipitation events here in Eastern North Carolina, we'll get anywhere between 50 and 100 folks that report those days. Now, when it's nice and sunny and warm out, folks sometimes tend to not report those, but zeros are just as important as days when it does rain.
Now, how many volunteer observers are there here in the eastern part of the state, and what type of information do they collect for you for the program, David?
Okay, well, in its most basic form, the type of information they collect for us are daily rainfall, snow, and hail reports. One part that's not mentioned there in the acronym is drought. Drought reporting is also a very unique aspect of the COCORAS program. Folks can report on how drought may be impacting their conditions, whether it's the grass has turned brown or the pond adjacent to my yard is dried up substantially. So that's just some examples of the data that we can use here each day. In Eastern North Carolina, we have between 75 and 150 folks that report throughout the year, but on average it's between 50 and 100 that report during precipitation events.
Is this a program that runs 365 days a year, or are there certain seasons in which you are most interested in the results?
No, this is year-round. It's something that if folks are interested in weather, we'd really like to encourage them to get involved with the program. It's a citizen science type of program that not only do we get to use the information here at the National Weather Service, but there's a plethora of other users here across the area. One good example is in Eastern North Carolina. Folks like seafood, right? So folks pay attention to what's going on with shellfish sanitation and harvesting rules for oysters and clams and other things to eat. What's unique about the COCORAS program is the data from COCORAS is used with the shellfish sanitation and water quality division of the Department of Environmental Quality here in Eastern North Carolina to help determine shellfish closures. So somebody taking an observation near the coast can have a hand in helping warn. For example, if you had an instance in the summertime where you had 2 inches of rain in a short period of time, not only is that something that could possibly cause some flooding issues, but it's something that could lead to bad water quality issues and therefore shut down some of the shellfish harvesting area just temporarily until the water quality improves.
As a volunteer is concerned, how long does it take each day to take the measurements that are needed for you?
Well, when it's a liquid precipitation, when it's rainfall, it's quite easy. It's just a few minutes a day. One of the ways is to log into the Coco Ross website, cocorahs.org. And file your information each day. Another opportunity, another thing that you can do is use the app. They have an Android and iPhone app, so it makes it even easier. You can just use your phone to log how much you've received in the past 24 hours.
What type of tools do volunteers need to get started with this program?
Well, obviously, I just mentioned the website and the phone access. So the number one thing is probably the internet access. You have to be able to get onto the internet to log the observations each morning. The other thing is a Coco Ross rain gauge. It's a 4-inch plastic rain gauge that reads the precipitation values out to the nearest 100th of an inch. So it's very precise and it's uniform. It's something that's used all across the country. So when we're comparing rainfall from one end of the state to the other, we're able to compare it from apples to apples.
As a meteorologist, David, how are you able to use the information that's collected by the Coco Ross volunteers?
Well, there's two main ways that we get to use the information. One is each morning we look at the collection of rainfall reports or precipitation reports of the previous 24 hours. So we look at that each morning, but we also can look at things in real time. So if somebody's a Coco Ross member and they observe 2 inches of rainfall in 30 minutes in Greenville, that's something they could submit instantly to us. And one of the unique aspects of that is that alerts us here at the National Weather Service, and it may lead to issuing a flood warning that could then help save lives and property.
During the month of March, the National Weather Service is particularly ramping up the participation here in the Coco Ross program. How can people get involved?
Well, one of the unique things we like to do, it's similar to the basketball March Madness. Coco Ross, we conduct our own little March Madness competition between all the states and the nation. One of the reasons is each year, roughly 25 to 30% of the people drop out of the program for various reasons, one being they either lose interest or they lose time or even move out of the state. What we need to do is to each year try to push to get new recruits to fill in those locations where we've lost people. Here in Eastern North Carolina, some of the areas we'd really like to focus are more of our rural areas, some of our higher populated cities like New Bern, Kinston, Greenville, Morehead City, Jacksonville. Our higher populated cities have some observers, but some of the rural parts of the counties, and especially locations adjacent to bodies of water, are places where we'd really like to get some new observers to really fill in the gaps of the precipitation network here in Eastern North Carolina.
And David, thank you so much for being our guest today on the Down East Journal.
Yes, sir. Thank you again.
The musical King Mackerel and the Blues Are Running has had successful runs on Broadway and at Washington, D.C.'s Kennedy Center over the last 25 years. It makes its way to Eastern North Carolina in 2 weeks with a pair of performances by the original three-man cast. George Olson spoke with the play's co-author, who also comprises one-third of the original performing ensemble, and has this, which originally aired in June 2004.
King Mackerel and the Blues Are Running, Songs and Stories of the Carolina Coast, is about as regional a concept as you can get, witness the title. So it would stand to reason that taking the show much further north than, say, Virginia Beach, might not be the wisest of ideas. Reason didn't prevail, and neither did the expected reaction.
I remember the evening that critic Clive Barnes came, because I thought, this man, I mean, I knew he liked our kind of theater, but still you don't know, but I thought we were in good shape when I looked out and I saw the lead critic for the New York Post with both his arms stretched toward the stage, wanting to have us throw rubber worms at him.
King Mackerel and the Blues Are Running all along the coast. Talk about fishing, you can't give the fish away.
Lan Simpson, the co-author of King Mackerel with Jim Wan, he estimates the musician's theater piece has been performed up to 500 times since the first production in the mid-80s, most of those performances across the state, but including forays into the aforementioned New York in a 1996 run at the Kennedy Center. Simpson, Wan, and Don Dixon have been the entire cast of the three-man production for each of the performances, Not bad, considering that when Juan and Simpson initially took on the project, they had no inkling they would ever perform it themselves.
Something that was proposed to us by a very fine fellow from Sanford, Ron Parkinson, who's a lawyer and a good friend of the Embers. And he called me up one time and said the Embers would like to do a musical and asked if Jim and I might be interested in writing such a thing. And Jim and I were saying, well, you know, what kind of musical would the Embers do were they to do a musical? And the answer would be a beach musical. And not too deep into the thing, the Embers realized what a lengthy rehearsal process musicals went through. And at some point they said, you know, this sounds like fun, but we're on the road all the time. And they had really been thinking in terms of something with a tiny rehearsal period. And that's just not the way they work. So anyway, by that point, though, Jim and I had written a few songs. And we said, well, we were having a lot of fun working together on this particular material, and we just kept at it. But that's where the idea came from.
The idea behind the show is relatively simple. The Coastal Cohorts, Bland, Jim, and Don, come together for an evening of songs and stories to help raise the necessary funds to rebuild the Corncake Inlet Inn, damaged by a hurricane. There is no actual Corncake Inlet Inn, though folks want there to be. All there is an actual Corncake Inlet, which folks long to see again.
Jim and I were down in Brunswick County one time. We went to see James Harper, the editor and co-publisher with his wife Margaret of the State Port Pilot down there, and he was telling us about Corncake Inlet. He said all the troubles of this county, the fishermen sum up by saying, well, they need to reopen Corncake Inlet. That'll fix everything. And Jim and I just thought that was a wonderful name for a place, so we created the Corncake Inlet Inn, which seemed to have a funny sound to it. But we talk about it with true conviction, as if it really exists, and it does in our hearts and minds. And a lot of people have asked us after a performance, you know, is there an 800 number? How can I book a room at the Corncake Inlet Inn? So we believe in it.
Oh, there's a safe harbor when the clouds are gathering. We can raise the corncake. The Corncake Inlet Inn. Yeah, there's a safe harbor where you can meet a friend. So raise a glass to the corncake. The Corncake Inlet Inn.
There's even a ring of truth to the fictional inn's proprietress, Miss Maddie Jewell.
I knew a lady down in Nag's Head who had a little more of a motel and hotel called the Pink Shell. And her name was Jewel Graves. Very fine person and energetic and really good motelier. And she had full of stories and so forth. And that's where the name Maddie Jewel came from. And I took Jim by to see, one time we were down there, to see Miss Graves. So she was a model, served as a model for the character who doesn't appear in the show but is talked about a good deal.
The greatest authenticity perhaps comes from where authenticity might least be expected to be found, fish stories.
We had a bunch of fishing stories, mainly from Jerry Leith Mills, J.L. Mills, who taught Elizabethan literature here at Carolina for many years and now lives in Little Washington, the original Washington, and teaches at ECU. But Mills is quite a sportsman. He had a lot of funny stories, and so we taped him telling these stories and then scripted from his spoken word and reworked them to make them most effective on stage.
You catch a kingfish, fight him and haul him in, spend your life looking for the thrill again. Whoa, 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 catch a king.
Alas, no matter how many ties to real life people and places the Corncake Inlet Inn has, it's still just fiction, a dream. The production's lead vocals primarily feature Jim Wan and Don Dixon. However, one of the show's highlights come when they turn the lead over to Bland Simpson toward the end of King Mackerel for Home on the River, a song with some personal meaning for Simpson, a dream within the Corncake Inlet Inn dream, so to speak, for the UNC Chapel Hill creative writing professor.
That really is an abiding, wishful thinking fantasy of mine. I lived on Pasquotank River and Elizabeth City when I was a boy for the first 10 years of my life. And as lovely as it is up here in the hill country, there is not a river running through Chapel Hill. It's one thing we lack. I have to confess to daydreaming on occasion while up here in the Piedmont, thinking about one day, you know, home on the river somewhere down east.
Well, I'm taking you down to a home on the river, taking you down to that great big old bay where nothing's forsaken and all is forgiven. Oh, love of my life, I want to lead you astray.
The Core Sound Waterfowl Museum and the North Carolina Coastal Federation present the coastal cohorts, Bland Simpson, Jim Wan, and Don Dixon, for two performances of King Mackerel and the Blues Are Running at Jocelyn Hall on the Carteret Community College campus in Moorhead City. Performances are Saturday, April 8th at 7:30 p.m., plus a Sunday, April 9th matinee at 3 p.m. I'm George Olson.
Then you showed me the wonders of the world outside. Now I'm trying to do the same. Oh, I'm taking you down.